Hi, this is Barry Listed Informs, the Institute for Operations Research in the Management Sciences. You're listening to Science of Better, a series of podcasts about ways that analytics and math modeling help people like you and organizations like your own. Patients, physicians, and hospital administrators alike have complained for some time about the disorganization in emergency rooms, especially ERs in inner cities. If the key problems are traffic flow and congestion, can operations researchers help? In today's segment, we speak with Dr. Douglas Samuelson, president of the consulting group Infologix, together with physician Dr. David Eitel of the WellSpan Health System in York, Pennsylvania. He's written an article called OR in the ER that appears in the August 2011 edition of ORMS Today. Our listeners will probably remember him speaking with us last year about American politics, and Doug is a regular contributor to ORMS Today as a columnist. Doug, welcome to the Science of Better.
Thank you, Barry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. David Ansell, a Chicago physician, recently wrote a book called County, Life, Death, and Politics at Chicago's Public Hospital. In an NPR interview, he talked about how daunting it is to change practices at an entire hospital that's overwhelmed and underfunded. Many ERs seem that way, too. Can you explain why emergency medicine has reached a crisis state in America today?
I don't know whether I can explain it, but I can certainly tell you some of what's going on.
Okay.
Dr. David Eitel, whom you mentioned, whom I just collaborated with for this feature article for ORMS Today, was hearing from colleagues as of about late 2006 that there was a steady and significantly increasing volume of demand coming into emergency departments around the country. And the congestion was increasing because we had gotten to the point, as you do on a highway, when there's enough congestion, then you start getting significant backlog and problems. One of the reasons for this, of course, was the attempts to contain cost in healthcare.
And now, let me just take you back one second, because you mentioned the highway, and it's interesting that you can compare two situations that seem so different, an emergency room, waiting room, and a highway, but that's something true about people who analyze things in our field.
Well, a highway is a service. An emergency department is a service. The checkout registers at a department store are a service, and in every one of those cases, you've got some service being performed that takes some time and requires some resources, and people coming in wanting that service. When you get close to the capacity of the service, the congestion increases dramatically, exponentially, because there is variation. It's not a smooth increase at all. And the reason I use the highway is that everybody knows a freeway that's just fine most of the time at rush hour turns into a parking lot with nothing having changed except the volume that's being presented. Now, the other thing, as I said, with emergency departments is that the attempts to be more efficient, for which our profession is partly responsible, tried to get optimal rather than being robust. So we tried
which
to get...
Which means what?
I'm about to explain.
Okay.
We tried to get as efficient as possible. Let's not have a lot of slack capacity in this system most of the time. You could do with a few fewer beds. You could do with a couple fewer docs. You could do with a little less of this and a little less of that, and it would be more efficient and more profitable, except when you get a surge in demand, at which point you get overwhelmed. So we had two trends butting into each other, a steadily increasing demand for health care and for urgent health care, because people have become better educated about when you have a pain like this or a cough like that, don't treat it yourself, get somebody to look at it. And at the same time, we're trying not to have as much slack capacity in our healthcare system, which means that when we get hit with an epidemic or an attack of some kind, or just the ordinary variations in seasonal diseases like influenza, it's easy to get close to that carrying capacity and get overwhelmed.
Take us back to 2006. That's when your co-author, Dr. Eitel, who's an emergency physician, gave a talk at an Informs meeting. He talked about the seriousness of ED or emergency department overcrowding at that time. What are some examples of alarming waits at emergency rooms?
One of the things he talked about at the time was that he had walked into his own emergency department and seen these signs, numbered signs, hanging from the ceilings in a lot of the hallways around the hospital. They had so many people being temporarily lodged on gurneys out in the hallways that they started labeling the areas so that they would have a clear record of who had been stashed where, so that the next person, when treatment became available, would know where to find that patient. This is, as he said, a sign of fairly serious system breakdown.
And, of course, from the consumer perspective, it's one of these things that all patients fear and dread.
Well, they did some studies in a number of EDs. I say they. He and some of Dr. Eitel and some of his colleagues did a number of studies. The number one patient complaint about emergency departments they had experienced was time they waited to be seen. And, of course, one of the big statistics that EDs look at to assess how they're doing is how many people left without being seen.
An interesting thing to measure, and, of course, upsetting because those people needed care and didn't get it.
It's not unusual in a large urban ED, emergency department, if you came in with something that is not clearly life-threatening at a busy time, to wait 8 hours to be seen. And that's a long time when you've got a stomach ache bad enough to take you to the ED in the middle of the night.
The article talks about what operations researchers would call a resource problem with no additional funding being provided. Healthcare deliverers keep falling behind as more and more people arrive in an ER, and you've got a bottleneck. Can you tell us a little more about that kind of a situation?
Well, go to any big city emergency department on a Saturday evening, and you can see it for yourself. I suggest that you stand back out of the way so you don't get run over by people trying to do things. But it's easy to see. In most suburban settings, like where I live, Fairfax County, Virginia, your doctor, if you call him, will tell you, if you get into a life-threatening emergency, you go to big hospital, best emergency department in the county. If you've got bad abdominal pain, but it doesn't appear to be life-threatening, maybe you've got a kidney stone, or you know, maybe you've got a minor intestinal infection that's causing a lot of pain, go to satellite urgent clinic so-and-so. You'll be seen a lot faster. And if you need to be transported to big emergency department, you'll be transported in a high triage state by that urgent care clinic. So people are already coming up with protocols to work around the problem, and that's the surest indication you could ever have that the problem is well known.
Something else that's in your article that gets pointed to extends beyond the emergency room. What problems often occur when patients are shuttled from the emergency room to another part of the hospital when they're finally assigned?
Well, one of the reasons that we have the problem we do in emergency departments is, in fact, downstream. You're trying, once a decision is made to admit a patient, the patient has been stabilized to the point where they don't need critical acute care right now to keep them alive, but they do need ongoing care. You want to admit them and send them to a regular unit in the hospital that deals with the type of ailment they have. The problem that often exists, especially since it's the middle of the night and it's a busy season, and sometimes it's the time when, for whatever reason, the rest of the hospital is not at full capacity, you don't have an appropriate bed in an appropriate unit to send that patient to. You're done with emergency care. You want follow-up care by somebody who's actually more of a specialist in what the patient has. The ED doctor may have diagnosed a kidney problem. He's not a nephrologist. You want this patient now, having been stabilized, under the care of a nephrologist, but there are only certain units in the hospital where the nephrologists practice. If you don't have a bed in one of those units, what do you do? You may put them in any available bed and then hope the nephrologist knows to get there and the information is handed over correctly about what's needed and where.
But they might be in another unit.
Or you may just
be overlooked.
Stash them on a gurney in the hallway waiting for the unit downstream to open up.
Let me remind our listeners that this is a Science of Better with Barry List of Informs. Our guest today is Doug Samuelson, who's discussing his article, OR in the ER, which appears in the current issue of the Informs membership magazine, ORMS Today. When it comes to optimizing the use of scarce resources or flow problems or decision trees, this is where operations researchers are very much in their element. These are some of the issues in ERs, as we've just been talking about, phrase the way operations researchers would phrase it. Maybe you could give us an example or two of OR in the ER, and why don't we start with something called the Emergency Severity Index.
When people enter an emergency department, what usually happens first is that they wait for a triage nurse to perform a classification of how urgently they need care. That's what triage means. And they're going to be put in a category, this person's in imminent danger of dying, top priority, get them care right away. This person is serious, needs to be here, but doesn't need to be treated in the next half hour. Keep them here, try to keep them comfortable, but they're not as urgent. And then there are people who, well, okay, you don't really need emergency department care, but if you want to sit here until we can get around to you, we'll do the best we can for you. And those are the people who end up waiting 8 to 12 hours. And if you categorize them wrong, if you classify them wrong, they become acutely distressed while they're waiting. One of two things happens. You miss it, they die. You have a preventable death in your emergency department, which is, by the standards of most people, the worst thing that could happen. But the next worst thing that can happen is, oh my gosh, this person's dying, code blue or stat or whatever phrase you use to indicate we've got somebody who needs critical care right now, and you interrupt the care of some other patient who was considered fairly urgent for some of your staff to rush to save this one. That does two things. First of all, it really screws up the flow and the waiting time and just the experience of the ER. But also, even people who are used to dealing with crises every day perform better if they can keep some stability and some regularity in what they do and how they do it. Constant interruptions to do something urgent diminishes anybody's productivity. And when what you're talking about is a doctor and some nurses, an emergency room team, saving lives, that means that quality of care is affected.
And the emergency severity index is a way to do a better job of triage?
What it was is that rather than having each nurse doing triage, doing what he or she learned some years ago, probably from another nurse, probably from a mentor, not in school, and doing it perhaps inconsistently, let's put all that we know into a system, a little coding system like a credit scoring system for granting credit, or like a scoring system for some kinds of performance. Just let's get it consistent, and let's get it systematized so that everybody who's doing triage is doing it the same way. That means that if we have somebody code in the wrong class, we go back and change the information about how you classify that set of symptoms. You don't have individual judgment affecting who gets the most urgent care versus who needs it.
And that's a good way of improving wait times and other problems, associated problems like patient safety or anger in the waiting room.
It is reported to have helped on all of the above. It is not the best thing you can do. And it turns out that triage is a bottleneck. And triage is often done because of another bottleneck that doesn't have to be there. In most emergency departments, the standard practice is you get triaged so that we can decide the priority with which we assign you a bed. And you get a physician to look at you after you're in a bed. There is no reason that it has to be that way. It depends on the ailment. Some people, they're not ambulatory. Yeah, you got to put them in a bed or on a gurney or something. But if somebody's in there who walked in with acute abdominal pain, and all you really need to know is this something that needs urgent care or not? You don't need a bed to diagnose them. Have them go straight to the doc.
And so this is an aha moment, something that everyone has been doing all the time. All of a sudden, we realize it doesn't have to be done. Everybody doesn't need a bed.
This was an aha moment for Dave Itell and a couple of other people. And what they came up with was something they called door to doc. Rather than having people triaged and then wait for a bed and then have the doctor go to the bed, it's easier to get more doctors into the ED in a crunch than it is to get more beds in there because your space is limited. But you can call docs in from other parts of the hospital, or you know, people who are off shift can be brought in. Get doctors to patients very quickly. Let them do triage. Let's find out real fast who really needs care and what kind of care. And you can be providing the care, or you can give them a better idea of how long they'll have to wait and let them make an informed decision. You put people in beds when they need beds.
So door to doc takes away one layer that was slowing things down.
Right.
By the way, this begs a question. When we talk about bottlenecks, we're also thinking about demand. And how predictable is demand in an ER?
More than most ED people think.
Huh.
People know. I mean, it is true, and I'm going to make two statements that seem to be contradictory, but they're both true. First of all, you never know what you're going to get. You've always got variation. You've always got surprises. And second, in the aggregate, when you look at overall numbers on average, it's fairly predictable. Saturday night always looks different from Tuesday morning in fairly predictable ways, unless a building caught fire and collapsed Tuesday morning. You know, when you've got an unusual event, that changes things. But the typical flow into an ED is fairly predictable in terms of the volume and the kinds of ailments you're going to see. You see a lot more gunshots Saturday night than you do Tuesday morning.
And I assume you see greater volume on Saturday night.
Yeah, Saturday night's bad.
And therefore you can schedule for volume.
You can expect it. And you can
plan for it. If you have resources, you can...
Now, again, one of the things that will happen, the reason you doctors are trained, and it's very strong training. Specialize, specialize, specialize. Narrow down to what you know really well, and you're the authority on that. The things that medicine in general does worst are the system problems, where your specialization doesn't help you. You've got to look at the whole system. One of the things that happens in an emergency department is you have to look at all the resources that might be needed depending who or what came in. You know that you need more surgical suites, you schedule them, you schedule the doctors, you schedule the surgical nurses, you schedule the resources, but if what you needed those surgical suites for might involve a pathology report on something they removed from somebody, did you remember to schedule up more lab technicians? As we OR people know, often what you do when you attack one problem at a time is you just move the bottleneck around the system. And it can take a long time with a lot of trial and error to remove all the bottlenecks.
Another example I understand is something called QTRAC, and I understand that it's a system used at a medical center in New Orleans. What is it?
That's my understanding as well. It was developed by Dr. Joe Guarisco, G-U-A-R-I-S-C-O, who will be my co-author on a feature article for ORMS Today in the very near future about QTRAC.
So our listeners can turn to ORMS Today to read that.
Oh, we want our listeners to turn to ORMS Today frequently to read all the good things we present, of course.
Of course.
What he did was basically trial and error. He removed a bottleneck and saw where the problem moved, and he attacked that bottleneck and saw where it moved, and over time, he developed basically just a protocol. Ask these questions in this order, and if you've developed the answers to them based on your experience that makes sense, your ED will work a whole lot better. What he did not do, because he had no idea that there was such a thing, is set the whole thing up in a simulation, which would have identified the balance problems and the sequential bottleneck potentials in a day. He had to do this the hard way. And naturally, he and other people like him, now that they have learned a little bit about what OR can do, are eager to find how we could help with this sort of thing and how we could spread that word to other people in the healthcare professions.
And I understand that Dr. Eitel's website features QTRAC. His website is www.nowaited.com. Do you know what other kinds of resources are there?
Various things he has heard about, many of which he was involved in developing, to move toward this ideal, which he believes is attainable and some of his colleagues believe is attainable with reasonable resourcing, called a no-wait ED. You go in there, you get seen. You're not waiting for 3 hours. You're probably not waiting for 15 minutes. You go in there and you find out right away whether you need to be there, what you need, how long it's going to take to get it. You're not waiting around just to find out, why do you have this pain?
That would be an amazing accomplishment.
And it's a necessary accomplishment, because what we haven't talked about yet, again, I alluded to it briefly, healthcare is a national security issue. If we ever get hit with a big pandemic or a big attack with a lot of walking wounded coming out, it's going to overwhelm the capacities of our emergency care system. And we need a plan for how we're going to deal with that. In particular, with a pandemic, one of the things we know is that if we got a flu epidemic and a whole lot of people showed up at the emergency department, if we handle things the way we usually do, with everybody in the same waiting room and in contact with each other for hours, the emergency departments would become the major vehicle of spread of the epidemic. If we have an epidemic, what we want everybody to do is stay home, and we'll deliver meds when we find the appropriate ones to you.
And, of course, that also touches on our topic of today, which is improving flow in the emergency room. Let me just remind listeners, I'm Barry Liss. This is The Science of Better, and we're talking with Doug Samuelson. What kind of efforts are being made to provide predictive analytic tools to ER management?
Well, the efforts I know about, there are a number of people now in OR, I'm happy to say, who have taken the trouble to familiarize themselves with at least some aspects of healthcare and are working in it. We had a focused conference, Informs conference on healthcare in Montreal in June, with 400 people there, including, I'm very happy to say, some medical people who wanted to see what was being done and learn about it. But most of the people there were people who had done some work that was of some relevance in this area. And I'm just overjoyed. I go back 20 years in healthcare in OR. I can remember when the healthcare applications section of then ORSA, before ORSA and TIMS merged to be Informs.
All right, the Operations Research Society of America.
And the Institute of Management Sciences.
Uh-huh.
It was like 30 people. The OR people who had taken the trouble to familiarize themselves with the healthcare environment and be able to talk that language and understand what doctors were telling them without repeatedly asking them to slow down and translate were few, and now there are many, so the potential is there. There are a few doctors like Dr. Eitel and Dr. Grorisco and Ed Popovich and a few others with whom I have talked and from whom you will be hearing more and seeing more, who have caught on and say, okay, you guys are the ones who can help us. What do we do? And part of the answer is we ought to be going to each other's conferences. We ought to be doing more of these joint publications, not only in ORMS Today, but also in some of the medical publications. There's a training course that Dr. Eitel has developed for medical people to learn what OR can do.
Fantastic.
That he's promoting around the country. And what he has now suggested, and I think is a wonderful idea, is that we ought to put some OR people through a version of that that familiarizes them with what the problems are. So we start talking to each other. We start working together and start developing a cadre of people who can solve these problems.
Let me take a step back on this. You write in the article that one thing standing in the way of more widespread applications of OR in the ER is simple lack of awareness of operations research in the medical field. And what's at issue here?
Well, Dave Eitel said that when he began emergency practice. He was in emergency practice for about 10 years before he went back for an executive MBA. And for that period, he had no idea what operations research or management science was, what it could do, that there even existed methods to look at problems like traffic flow and congestion and resource allocation. And he went through this executive MBA, and he was just astounded and said, my goodness, why aren't we all using this? The answer he came to was that when OR people and medical people talk about this, the OR people typically talk about, here are the tools I know how to use. Surely this would be of some use to you, wouldn't it? And when you're not talking to any client, not just a doctor, about here are the problems I understand you have, here are some ways to get solutions to those problems, you're not talking his language or her language. And if they're busy, that's probably not going to go much further in that conversation. You've got to be able to say, I see where we could help you do X better, and be convincing about it.
Although I understand that people in the medical field can be somewhat resistant to trying things outside of the medical field.
Well, you never want to try to tell a physician, again, because of the culture of the profession. No physician ever wants anyone trying to tell them how to practice medicine. There was a fiasco about 15, 20 years ago when the artificial intelligence people and some OR people said, we can really help you with medical diagnosis. We can put it all into a computer, and the computer will come up with better diagnoses than any individual physician would. And the physician said, forget that. You're not going there, and we're not going there. If you had a system that a physician could consult that would say, consider this, consider this, consider this. Maybe you want to run this test. Maybe you want to ask this question. Leaving responsibility for diagnosis in the hands of the physician, but helping them do it, that is very sellable and very usable, and some such systems exist. Same way with an emergency department. If we were to come in and say, we can tell you how to run this better than you guys do, that's going to be a short conversation. But when we come in, especially when we come in arm in arm with an emergency department physician they respect and say, we know some ways you could run your ED more like his, which is seems to be working better, then you get serious attention, and I think you get some progress.
We only have time for one or two more questions. Can you run down the recommendations that Dr. Eitel made during his session at the Informs Health Applications Conference this past June?
Well, the biggest one was a plea to OR people, get knowledgeable about healthcare and get involved. We have more opportunities for people like you than we have people like you. So that was a big one. And then some of the other recommendations that came out of that were, as I mentioned, let's be talking at each other's conferences. Let's be presenting in each other's publications. Let's be working on joint training courses that will get our people collaborating with each other effectively. And as with any other great business idea, if it works well, the first adopters will be kicking the butts of their competitors, and that will get their competitors' attention better than anything else would.
Final question, how optimistic are you that doctors and operations researchers can work together with on OR and the ER?
Well, I'm always an optimist. One of my favorite quotes is Margaret Mead, "Never doubt the ability of a small group of thoughtful, concerned citizens to change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has."
And on that note, Doug, thanks for talking with us. And thank you for listening to the Science at Better podcast by Informs, the Institute for Operations Research and the Management Sciences. For more information about operations research and the series of podcasts, visit us on the web at www.informs.org. Good day, and remember, keep on crunching those numbers.